nights, and it was working, but many people complained it was a hard hour on the weeknight to come out. So we're trying once a month on Sunday mornings, and we hope that you will enjoy, and we've decided that the breakfast might be an additional draw in addition to the great shiur, and please spread the word so that we could build the enthusiasm for this really nice opportunity. And Ken and I are sponsoring this morning, and if anyone would like to sponsor future month's program, please speak to me and be happy to have your support. Thanks.
Thank you, Elise. People still coming. Good morning. Please grab some coffee and stuff before you sit down.
We have breakfast.
Please, breakfast. Put your phones on vibrate. Firstly, good morning and special yasher koach to the Panitches for not giving up on this. I had mentioned that the weekdays were particularly difficult for me this year. I've actually increased my teaching at yeshiva, so the Sunday morning was an option, and you dream it and it happens. So I'm really excited about that and very appreciative. Sorry? That's it. And it's good to segue into Zionism, because that was the same philosophy. Absolutely. Good. Thank you. What I am not going to do this morning, let me explain what the idea of doing Zionism. It's kind of, to me, it's a bit of a seum on our previous series, because we did A to Z. So I'm actually doing the topic that I was going to do for Z. So this is like the end of the line. But at the same time, it's also what they call here in this country, a concept which I've only come across in America, what they call commencement. At the end of the year, you have the commencement ceremony, right? Which means that instead of ending, you're actually beginning. Don't ask me how that works. It's a graduation. So this is kind of our commencement. We've graduated A to Z, and now we're commencing. Please got a new style, hopefully a new type of shiur. Just to announce for the next time, which I think will be in February, I think we're talking around second Sunday in February, I hope that will work out, I want to talk a little bit about the real story of Purim. I was teaching this semester in YU about the historical background of Purim. Many people don't know this. And it really is absolutely phenomenal. It will change the holiday for you, and hopefully, as my wife always says, there are a couple of holidays that she kind of wants to sit out, and Purim is clearly one of them, with Simchas Torah following very swiftly behind. Pesach, I don't even want to talk about P word, but at the same time, it's so phenomenal. The classic quotation, and I love quoting for my students, is the young lady who went through yeshiva day schools and really comes from a very solid background, and her father's a rabbi. And she said to me at the end of the semester, why did they not teach me this in high school? And I said, that's why you came to yeshiva, that's why you came to YU to learn it. So I thought that was a highest praise that I could have got from a student. I was really excited about that. Today we're going to talk about Zionism, and what I'm not going to do is tell you how to follow the Israeli elections, which are coming up in about 2 months' time, 3 months' time. I lived in Israel for 8 years and lived through two elections in Israel. In those days, I didn't understand what was going on. And today, Kal Vachomer, I really am not quite sure. Every day there seems to be a new party, a new faction, a new group. And again, one wonders if the original founders of Zionism, if they would look at what's going on in Israel today from the political point of view. I stress, from the political point of view, would they be satisfied? Would they be horrified? I'm not quite sure. But it's the reality. It is what it is, and one has to work with it. And all I would suggest is that, you get your guru and try and follow it through Jerusalem Post or through whatever means you can, because it is important. It does sort of seal a bit of the future of, I would argue, not just Jewry in Israel, but Jewry around the world. In the end of the day, Israel represents who we are wherever we are. Whether we like it or whether we don't like it, even if we live in Brooklyn in the confines of what one would call the ghetto and everything else, what happens in Eretz Israel directly affects what happens to us around the world. That's always been a reality, but now I think even more so, and that's something which I think many Jews have to come to terms with, something we'll talk about in the course of what we're saying today. On the page in front of you, what I wanted to do is to look at the idea of Zionism in the 21st century. When I gave this year originally, nearly 20 years ago, there was a whole discussion about something called post-Zionism. don't know if you remember that particular expression. It was around the time of Ehud Barak, who we were talking about yesterday. He seems to have made a miraculous reappearance, a bearded gentleman now. I don't know whether that's for good or for better. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. And of course, at that time, right about the year 2000, 2001, all the discussions of what to give back and what he was prepared to compromise on, it was really quite shocking, and a lot of people were writing about, you know, is this the end of Zionism as we know it? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu had other plans, and it never came to fruition, and we have to say thank God. Looking, you know, with hindsight, we realize how dangerous the situation would have been, even more so if that would have gone through. So God was looking out for us, as we believe he does. But nevertheless, I think it's important we need to come to terms with the concept, I think, today of Zionism. But looking at it, I would like to suggest from a more religious perspective. Very often when we hear lectures on this, if you go to wherever it may be, the JCC, or you go to New York, or wherever the lecture takes place, it's usually coming from a more political perspective. Usually an ambassador or someone is talking in these terms. That's fine. But I think for people who are sort of more concerned from a religious perspective, how do we deal with, how do we approach Zionism in our day and age? Is it something which has already run its course in terms of the original idea, the original concept? What should be our inspiration? This is really the focus of what I want to talk about, the inspiration for us today in terms of going forward as, I would like to believe, committed Zionists in the biggest possible sense of the word, not just talking about political Zionism, but true Tzionut, the idea of Tzion. Tzion is something that we talk about in the highest Tzion, the Dov, Vodov, hallelujah. We say this 3-4 times every day. We talk about Zion the whole time. Let's understand what real, true depth of Zionism is, certainly from people who really lived it, and how it should affect us today. So before we get going on what you've got on the page, just talk a little bit of background. I'm always a bit upset. I didn't go to Jewish school in London, but I went to the standard Hebrew school arrangement, and part of my course, I would come in the first half an hour, Chumash Rashi, whatever it was, and then we had kind of a course on history, regular Hebrew school, and we studied for a whole semester the history of Zionism. It was just a given, and we went through the dates of the first Zionist Congress and Theodor Herzl and all the stuff which I took for granted. I grew up where we saw those early JNF films, which many of you, I imagine, will remember. That wonderful expression, Kova Tembel, you know, this hat that every great pioneer used to wear. We actually had a cousin, my wife's father had a cousin there at Israel who really was the poster boy for that particular image. Passed away a few years ago, Valishnan. He always looked like, with the Kova Tembel, the whole bit, the short sleeves that had to be folded another fold, even though they were short enough, you know, didn't really cover your arm. And that whole image was really something which was almost, you know, one felt by the time we got to a certain point, it was history. But is it? The first Congress, just to give a bit of background, 1896, and I think many of you know this, Theodor Herzl sort of came up with this idea of the Jewish homeland, the famous book that he wrote. And already, I think, more or less from 1840, maybe even 50 years before Herzl sort of put together this whole idea of the Zionist Congress, there had already been a beginning of return to Eretz Israel, the Talmidim. We know, we talk about the Talmidim HaGrod, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, the students, also the Hasidic community started, the Purushim, etc. You hear about this stuff in Israel, unfortunately today, when you have to deal with funerals. Because all of a sudden, all of the Chevra Kaddishas that you have to deal with are based in these historical terms. To which Chevra do you take? You take the Chevra of the Purushim, the Chevra Yerushalayim, and who are they? Where they coming from? Hasidish or not Hasidish? And all of this is bound in this early history, which was developed way back before political Zionism really took a foothold in the Jewish world. The famous names of the early pioneers, Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and Shmuel Moliver, these are names that, again, I grew up with, I'd read about, and I was taught about, and I always assumed that this is something that will be basic education for young people forever and ever. I would always think my kids and my grandchildren will know about this, and I guarantee you, I'd put my my grandson is a smart kid, and I put him in the room here and say, who was Svi Hiskalishe? He wouldn't know what I was talking about. And that's sad to me. I don't know this. There's been a disconnect. Rav Kalisha was one of the Gaonim of his day. He wrote responsa to Chasam Sofer. He wrote responsa to all the great rabbis about issues in Eretz Yisrael. Can we bring the Korban Pesach? He wrote a question in 1832. He wanted to do the Korban Pesach. Unbelievable. And he was told by the Chasam Sofer, the famous Rabbi Sofer in Pressburg in Hungary, halachically, yes. Politically, no. And that's interesting. 200 years ago, Rabbi Sofer realized that the Arabs would go berserk, even in those days when there was hardly any attention to the Temple Mount like there is today. Nevertheless, Rabbi Sofer said, no, you can't do it politically. It's just not going to happen. And kind of prophetic what he was writing at that time. The issue of the Zionist Congress, of course, became very controversial in the religious community because a lot of religious people divorced themselves from Zionism. They said this is a continuation of Haskalah, without going into what exactly that's about, enlightenment and breaking away from religious life, and, you know, all of the excuses and so on and so forth. And this went on and on and on right through, I would argue, through the Second World War and beyond. Even to this very day, there are sort of people who come out with a lot of this terminology, anti-Zionist from a religious perspective. And I just want to share with you really some of those concepts and show you why, from my personal point of view, I just can't go with this. Not only me, but thank God there were many great men before me who would say, you know, really great men, I'm talking not by myself, but people who sort of great tzaddikim who already disagreed with these ideas many, many years ago, these anti-Zionist ideas, which unfortunately still prevail in so many religious communities around the world. Let me give you an example here, the first source that you have on the page from the Gemara. And if you go to Monroe, upstate New York, or to Kiryas Yoel, or any of the Satmar Hasidic communities, you'll hear this Gemara being spoken to you when you ask about Zionism. They'll tell you about the Gimel Shavius, they'll pronounce it in the Hasidic pronunciation, the three oaths. So what are they talking about? Right, every kid there in the cheder does know this. Interesting, and this is a piece of Gemara from Gemara Ketubot. It's the first source on the page. Ahum eboy leichid Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina de Amar. The top line. Gimel Shavuos. There were three oaths. Halalu Lama. There was a reference, as you'll see here in the English translation from Shir Hashirim. There are references to three promises or more promises, three oaths that were made. That the Jews had to be were bound by three shavuot, three commitments. What were they? Achat, back to the Hebrew, the end of the first line. Shlo yalu Yisrael b'chomah. This is the one that they all quote to you. Lo yalu b'chomah. I've just quoted here underneath the English, the Rashi. Yachad biyad chazaka. We are not allowed, according to this Gemara, to go back to Eretz Israel biyad chazaka with a strong hand. That in itself immediately rules out Tzahal and everything else and Haganah and all the history, etc., etc. Because as far as the Gemara seems to be saying, we've got to sit around and wait for Mashiach. And we know this was a tradition which goes back into antiquity, to sit around and wait. What was the second one? Because you take it as a package. Interesting. The second one was an oath that God made upon Israel. Shelo yimardu b'umot olam. Not to rebel against the nations of the world. Wow. Okay, and that's again something which does sum up a lot of diaspora history going back a very long way. Sorry? Zay still, and put your head in the sand. Yeah, we know this. And then finally, interestingly, God made the non-Jews promise. Now, if this is a package, then you can see how you can get out of the whole commitment. They had to promise, Lo yishtabdu behem Yisrael, you tell me die. They won't, as he puts it, subjugate the Jews excessively, which of course is absolutely not the case. If one wonders about what happened in Egypt, you know, you sort of think about what people went through 50, 75, 80 years ago, then you understand that there's excessive and there is unbelievably excessive. And a lot of the rabbis already say, and look at this Gemara and say, well, look, certainly number three has gone out of the window because look at the way we've suffered in terms of Jewish history. So therefore, number one and number two also don't apply anymore. And this was an attitude of great rabbis, but people like the Avnei Nezer, who, again, I just throw out the names, but if you've heard of these rabbeim, Hasidisha Rebbe of a place called Sokotra, which he became very famous because he wrote a really authoritative book on the laws of Shabbat. The Or Sameach, Reb Meir Simcha of Divinsk, who I can't get over this. We always talk about two levels of separation around the world for Jews. Six levels in the regular world, two levels in the Jewish world. And it's not only two levels in the Jewish world in terms of current separation, but even historical separation. I had a teacher in London, Diane Fisher, Michael Fisher, who died. He was 94 years old. And he was a Gaon Olam. He knew Talmud by heart. A dayan in London who worked in one of the Bati Din. And he was a Talmud. He was a student of the Chofetz Chaim. He studied in Radin in Poland before the war. And he told us in a shiur once that he remembers meeting Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk. And he must have been probably, Rabbi Fisher at that time was maybe 10 years old. And he must have been taken to Divinsk. He must have gone there. There were two great rabbis there. There was Rav Meir Simcha Cohen, and there was somebody called the Rogachev Gaon. Rogachev Gaon is actually interesting because Herb Rosen, Al-Machutin, is related. Rosen, that was the name of the Rogachev family. Came from Rogachev. And Rosen, Herb's, I think, grandfather was a cousin of this famous rabbi in Poland. He was known as the Einstein of Poland, if you can imagine that. Right, they said, in fact, Einstein only had half the brains that this guy had. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. And he never cut his hair. If you see pictures of the Rogachev Gaon, he had long, flowing locks. And one of the reasons is because he just did not want to stop studying Torah, even for the moment it took to cut his hair. So he never had a haircut. It's unreal. He died in 1936. And again, you know, one reads stories about this. These are unreal personalities. This was Divinsk. Rogachev was the Hasidic Rebbe there, and Rav Meir Simcha, Rav Meir Simcha Divinsk, was the Lithuanian Gaon. So, just a little bit of background about a town called Divinsk, which I'm not sure what it's called in the... all these towns had Hebrew names or Yiddish names. They also had their Polish. I don't know what it's called in Polish, but that's what it was known as. Rav Meir Simcha writes after the Balfour Declaration, 1917, right? So this is 10 years essentially before he died. He said, at this point, everything to do with these three oaths has gone away. Because the reality is that now we're no longer subjugated to the non-Jews because we've been promised by Lord Balfour and together with the Rothschilds and everything that was going on in London at the time that there will be a Jewish homeland. And therefore all of this sense of being restricted has gone away. That was his comment. And he made that comment in public and a lot of people said, this is a phenomenon, and the Aliyah began to pick up, and we know there were different levels of Aliyah, the first Aliyah, the second, the third. It was it must have been an incredible time to live through at that point, because all of a sudden people were beginning to sense there's an end to this. There's an end to this endless nightmare of Galut, of diaspora, of darkness. It was coming to an end. And all of that really, to sum it all up, made the three O's essentially irrelevant in certainly the early 20th century and beyond, and I would say for the 21st century without a question. The fact is that Yalu B'choma, that the fact that now we're there, and the fact that we've been not only in Israel, but we've become tremendously successful with all of the issues, and you know, one doesn't even have to explain to anyone what exactly the issues are, but it's a phenomenon. The phenomenon of our existence in Israel today. What did Ben-Gurion say? You know, you've got to believe in miracles because everything in Israel is a miracle. I used to believe that sort of very on a daily basis because I used to work in Tel Aviv. I worked in Tel Aviv for a year traveling from Yerushalayim. And if you survived that trip every day, then you were living miracles. There's no other way to describe it. I literally was in a cab once where the cabbie decided he wants to sell his cab. And as he's driving at 100 kilometers an hour, the guy next to him winds down the window because there's a little sign in the window saying for sale. And they had this conversation on the highway. I shall never forget it because I was saying to him at the time, the guy was saying, Kama ole, how much do you want for the cab? And the other guy, the cab driver, was having this negotiation. And before they got to back, this is from Tel Aviv Jerusalem, before they got to Jerusalem, they pulled over to the side, shook on it, and he sold his cab. I thought, wow, you know, good Lord. It was really, really an experience that I don't want to relive again, but this is how it is. It's an amazing country. There's no other way to describe it. There's no words for it. Go back to the original objection. So if we'd done away with the Talmudic issue, then what was going on in let's say, post-First World War Hungary and Poland, etc., why was the Zionist ideal not adopted by the vast majority of rabbis? And I've heard people who are survivors from the Holocaust who and religious people who did not mince their words about their rabbinic leadership and were so, so bitter and critical of the Rebbes who managed to run away and the Hasidim and all the others who were left behind. And it pained me to hear it. I remember hearing this from someone living in Haifa a few years ago. It was terrible to hear. And there is that sense, that sense of bitterness, and I can't even begin to talk about it, but clearly what was going on sort of between the wars particularly was a sense still of Zionism being treif. Why did they say it was treif? Because it was founded by godless people, right? You looked at the films coming from Israel of those building in the various swamps and etc., and none of the people there were religious. And of course, the idea was that this was maybe a rebellion against religion. This is how it was presented, and part of the isms. If you read Rabbi Chonon Wasserman, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva before the Second World War, who was killed by the Germans in 1941, and he writes about Zionism as being one of the isms, communism and nationalism and Zionism. He puts them all together. And that was an attitude, that was an approach. But very, very interesting, of course, that the other main objection was the idea that a new Jew was being created in Israel. And you feel this even today, that there is this idea of the, I don't know how to describe it, we're no longer the Jew that cowers in the corner, that hides away from the, let's use the expression, from the goyim, sort of keeping away from it. The Jew today in Israel can stand up proudly and, have his or her place in the world. I mean, we just had, what was it, in judo or something, they played the national anthem in an Arab country, was it? Did you hear this news recently? It was an unbelievable thing. Things that are going on that thank God, we're proud to say to the world and to stand up and announce that we're Jews in a country and we're contributing to the world. And of course, we all know about Israel's contribution in terms of going the first people that end up in a crisis. Who's there? Who was in Haiti for anybody else? Was the Israeli army that got there with a field hospital when they had the earthquake, whatever it was. What was it, 10, 12 years ago? It's unreal. And this goes on all the time. We just don't know half of the stories of what happened. So basically, what I feel so strongly about is so much of the original antagonism to Zionism from the religious world today is really something which has to be put into maybe historical perspective, but I think we've just got to do away with this. We've got to get out of the mindset, as difficult as it is, and you will meet religious Jews and unfortunately sort of people who seem to be even more extreme, right, in terms of their dress and whatever, and they will come out with some anti-Zionist statements, and I have to say to myself, I don't know which world you're coming from, because you can't really believe what you're saying. How can you daven for towards Israel and face Jerusalem and think and all these things and say at the same time all this anti-Zionist stuff, which unfortunately is still very much part of the rhetoric that goes on in some communities around the world? So what I want to sort of focus on more positively is the state of religious Zionism. We all know about the Mizrahi party. They had their heyday in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s. I met once, and my wife was with me, Yosef Burg, wonderful, wonderful man. He should have been a Rav. He was representative of Mizrahi in the Knesset, and he was a man full of Torah. He was an unbelievable gentleman. And various other people like that, the heyday of religious Zionism, the Mizrahi, everything Dati Lumi today is much more complicated. I don't know whether even the Mizrahi party exists anymore. I'm not even sure what the state is. But when did it come about? We go back to the, I think, second or third Zionist Congress back in the early 1900s, and we've got somebody called Rabbi Yitzchok Reines. Rabbi Yitzchok Reines was, again, one of the Gaonim of Poland, who believed passionately in the Zionist cause from a religious perspective. And there were people who objected. People said to him, this is, you're becoming reform. You're going against the the traditions of our fathers. They spoke to him in this way. They said, how can you have allegiance with secular Zionists? They criticized him like mad. And over the years, Mizrahi has had to live through these types of of criticisms. And one of the sort of biggest issues, and something which I personally experienced, was the whole question of army service, which, of course, in terms of someone coming through the ranks of the Dati Lumi, the national religious grouping, would go to the army, be without question. And again, now we've had a very big change in something called Haridi, Nachal Haridi, that even amongst the what we would call the more right-wing religious groups, the idea of going to the army is being recognized now, slowly, but positively, as a good thing. And all of this sort of terms of religious Zionism, things that came about, things that grew up around it, it held it back. I always felt that there was some sort of sense that, you know, this is not maybe the real deal. Maybe not the real deal. I know when I was living in Israel, I sort of felt like that a little bit. On the other hand, you could see that things were beginning to change and more people were getting involved, understanding the political necessity for religious Zionism and also the values. And what I did, I was lucky enough when I studied in Kolon in Israel to look a bit into Rav Kook. And not only to look into Rav Kook, but another rabbi that I will share with you. And I really think the whole purpose of coming on a snowy morning in Cherry Hill was to find out not so much about Rav Kook, I hope you all know about, a little bit at least, but this other rabbi that you may not have heard of, who was a phenomenon. Rav Kook was born, again, in Lithuania, went to the Volozhin Yeshiva, very famous background of Rav Kook. I always felt that one of the things I wanted to meet my grandfather and discuss with him, because Rav Kook was a Rav in London when my grandfather died. He davened in the same shul. He was a Rav there for 3 years. And I always thought what a Shabbos would look like when you would have Rosenblatt coming as the guest chazan with Rav Kook darshaning. Imagine what a Shabbos, even if they took 5 hours, you'd stay for 5 hours, right? You wouldn't go home early to have that combination. I don't think so. I think I can't imagine. And Rav Kook, apparently, his English was superb. Right, apart from all the other language he spoke. That's why in 1917, he was in London. It was Min HaShemayim. He could go to, he was called in by the British government to testify before them in terms of establishing the Balfour Declaration. Rav Kook was there. Comes back to Israel in 1921 and became recognized as the chief rabbi of Palestine and died in 1935. And on the page in front of you, I have a piece from one of his letters. Not sure when this was written, and you'll see what he writes. And it's so phenomenal. This is a man I don't think who stood fools lightly. What I did hear from someone who remembers from the days when he was in London is that he used to walk to shul. It's on the east side of London, a bit like the Lower East Side in New York, and he had a police escort. And the reason why for that, I guess, he was recognized as being a personality that they had to protect or whatever. And apparently the non-Jews used to come out to watch that procession, because they were asked, why are you coming out in the masses? Every week it was like sort of the queen coming to visit. It was amazing. Well, in those days, the king. And the reality was that they all would say that this man reminds us of the King of England. He's like, he's royalty, the way he conducts himself. It's just a phenomenal thing that Rav Kook managed to achieve. Amazing. And in this letter, he has a letter from someone who complains that he's too Zionistic. So listen to this. This is one of my favorites. And it's only a piece of the letter. It's the first page at the bottom. He says, Masha Mecharfani Kavod Taras Rabbi. He's writing to one of the rabbis who, unfortunately, does not respect him that much. He says, the fact that you don't respect me, Shina Seiti La'ed Ziknuti, you're complaining that in my old age, I've become Zionist. I've become too much of a Zionist. Right? La'kriv et nishmati b'shvil yeshuv Yisrael b'eretz Yisrael, that I'm now got all of my energy, all of my focus on the yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael. Ahuvi, and look at the way he talks to this man, who's obviously not one of his friends. He says, my friend, Ahuvi, my beloved, he calls him. Im kol atzionistim, he wished that if all the Zionists, you love him at Eretz Yisrael, they would love Israel, the land of Israel, and they would want to develop the land of Israel, with the holy purpose, which I intend, and I think of every day of my life, because this is the land of God, Shebachaba Hashem Yitbarach, which God has chosen, v'chibaba mikol olam kula, and is beloved more than anywhere else in the world, even though it's the size of New Jersey, and it's a tiny blip, essentially. V'yesh bas segulot kedusha l'nevuah, and it's a place of great holiness for prophecy. What he writes, so beautiful. Lashrad Ruach HaKodesh, that the Holy Spirit can come there. Lizkot al yidei halicha bal olam haba. You go there, you merit the world to come. 4 steps in Eretz Yisrael, and you've already got a portion in the world to come, according to the Gemara. He says, V'afilo al rishaim megina zechuta, and it even protects the wicked. The story, Yaakov Avinu is coming back to Eretz Yisrael, and he's worried about Esau. And you'll say to me, Yaakov, you're a tzaddik. Esau is a big rasha. What are you worried about? And one of the rabbis writes, he says, you know what? The reality was, Yaakov lived for 22 years outside Israel, and Esau was living 22 years in Israel. He's a rasha, he's an evil man, but he's living in Eretz Yisrael. He's got that merit. And Yaakov was worried. He says, I haven't got that merit. I was outside Israel. I was with Lavan. There was the whole story there with the sheep and everything else. You know, he was worried. And that's that, again, just proves you don't have to be holy to live there. The fact is that, you know, whatever you are there, it's a tremendous zechut. Ideally, at least we should visit, but certainly if we're lucky enough to live there, what a zechut, what a merit it is. And he goes on and on and on. He basically says, halavai, all the Zionists would be like me. You want to accuse me of being Zionist? He says, guilty as charged. Absolutely guilty as charged. And he says, halavai, they should all be like me. And Rav Kook, one of the famous things about Rav Kook was, and it's quoted by Norman Lamb in one of his essays, which is really worth reading. He says Rav Kook had a whole different way of looking at the world. And this is what I love so much. Rav Kook's way of looking at the world, he says, we normally look at the world, there's holy and there's profane. There's Kodesh and Chol, right? Kodesh in high school. You have Jewish studies and what they call secular studies. So what does Rav Kook say? Rav Kook writes this in many places. He says, no, that definition is wrong. He says everything is Kodesh. He says there's holy and not yet as holy. In other words, it's becoming holy through a course of time. Even things like science, even things around the world, studies which we would have, math or whatever, he saw within it an essence of the knowledge, awareness, you know, it's coming from the mind that God has given us, and therefore he would see it as a sense of holiness even in something which is less than holy as far as we are, not Torah studies, but other studies. And therefore, Rav Kook attended, as you can look at it online, I think it's on YouTube, the famous opening of the Hebrew University in 1925. And the whole front line there, you've got all the British generals there with the helmets and all the rest of it, you know, all looking very, very prim and proper. And in the middle of it all, there's a rabbi sitting there with a shtreibel. You think this is very strange. And who is the rabbi sitting there? It's Rav Kook. And Rav Sonnenfeld was not there. You know, the head of the Badatz did not go to the Hebrew University opening, but Rav Kook did. And he spoke, and he gave a drasha. And he said that this is part of the return to Eretz Yisrael because we are recreating not only the holiness of Israel in terms of yeshivot, etc., etc., but also in terms of this study, this awareness of God's creation, etc., etc., everything that will go on in the university, which he saw in such a positive way. Amazing man. Had I had the zechud, if any of us had the zechud to sit in Weni Drosha from Rav Kook, I don't think we would be sitting here today talking about are we Zionist or not. This man must have generated that closeness to Eretz Yisrael. I can't even imagine what it was like. I know I have a remnant from my grandfather, a little tie pin. And the tie pin, my mother told me, was something that he got awarded for the Palestine fundraiser. I don't know what exactly they're raising money for Palestine in those days. And I just can't imagine that anyone who would have heard Rav Kook over those 3 years that he was in London would not have been so imbued with that sense of closeness to Eretz Israel. They, you know, certainly to raise funds and everything else that was going on, it was just kind of a given. This was an amazing man, an inspirational man. And this is part of the Zionism, the positive religious Zionism, which I think we all need to learn about. We need to recharge our batteries. And I'll explain why at the end, because being on the campuses as I am, I see what's going on there. There's a big issue. Rav Kook, I just want to put into one corner over here. You can take a seat, get a cup of coffee. I've got another rabbi over here. He probably won't drink the coffee because he won't drink Dunkin' Donuts. He came from Hungary. Doesn't matter. He still was a holy man. And a different rabbi who people have not heard of. A gentleman by the name of Yisachar Teichter. I've just got a picture of him and his eyes. Just the eyes follow you around the room, so just be careful. It's one of those sort of pictures. definitely of the Satma persuasion, as you can see, wearing the uniform. Unbelievable man. In the 1920s, 1930s, followed the Satmar Rebbe 100%, anti-Israel, gave the fiery droshes against the evils of Zionism, etc., etc. He gets to the beginning of the Second World War, and he's running for his life. He was not living in Budapest at the time. I think he was based in Czechoslovakia or somewhere of that in that part of the world, and he had to run. Eventually, he got to Budapest. And in 1943, he's hiding in, he writes in a bunker, calls it, in a basement somewhere in Budapest. And he has none of his possessions with him. I think most of his family has already been killed, and he knows. And he's crying his eyes out. He's crying his eyes out about a lot of things. But one of the things he's really, really crying about is the fact that we had a chance, he says, in the 1920s and the 1930s to take up the challenge of going to Eretz Yisrael, and we didn't take up the challenge. He changed his view on Zionism so dramatically, it's beyond belief. Again, I just want to show this to you. Look on the page. If you go over to the other side of the page, I'll just read this very quickly. A part of this book, this book to me is, I call this his Shir Ashirim to Israel. It's now it's actually translated in English, Eim Habanim Smecha. Unbelievable book. This is a man, again, he actually was taken to Auschwitz in 1944 and he was killed in Auschwitz. But I think two of his sons survived and there is now family in Israel, Teichdal. That's the name. And I got a letter from a Rabbi Teichdal, I suspect is his grandson. They're trying to promote his writings, etc., etc. When was this letter sent to me? Doesn't say. A few years ago. To our honored and distinguished friend, Rabbi Ian Schaffer. That was very nice. I didn't deserve that title. Wow. Anyway, that was. I must have sent them a good check. I don't remember what I sent them. Whatever it was, I got a good response. Look at this, what he writes in 1943. And you cry when you read this. He says like this. He says, Shamati mipi magide emes. He said, I heard all the great rabbis, particularly in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, you know all the religious neighborhoods in Israel, they're all named after these towns in Hungary. And there's Unsdorf, there is a neighborhood called Unsdorf, and there was an Unsdorf Rebbe, probably is one today, I don't know who he is. And he says, 1918, this Rebbe said, Shama b'zeh loshen, it's in Yiddish, I'll translate. He says, oi, well, that I don't need to translate, we'll know what that means. He said, ich zeh, he says, I see that God forbid Yidden velen nish kenen verbleiben do in die Medinas. Jews will not be able to stay in these countries, meaning Eastern Europe. He saw it, 1918. Und men vet musen laufen, we're going to have to run. Men vet nish hoben wie zu laufen, we've got nowhere to go to. This was the Rebbe saying this. Favos zeit men nish. Ois to boy, why don't people get the point that we need to build the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, to build the Yishuv, build the world, the developing community in Israel? Ad Khan Devarav HaKadosh, he says, this is what I heard from the Rebbe saying, he said, Asher Dibe Baruch Kodesh. He said it with literally Ruach HaKodesh, with divine spirit. For who Batzmo Shtadel B'davar Mabaze, he himself, this Rebbe of Unsdorf, tried so hard. V'ko hayu dvarav lefanai kav hei shanim. I've never forgot it for 25 years. So you can see, 1918, he's now writing in 1943. And this is a year before he died. He wrote this book, 300-page book. He didn't have one sefer, no svarim, not a library like this, nothing. Everything was from his head. He quoted Midrashim, Talmud, everything. He knew it all by heart. This man was incredible. And he just says, I mean, again, you cry. Look what he says here. Just it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down. He says, V'az, Oda Yasheket V'shananut B'Medinot El. He says, 25 years ago, 1918, it was quiet in these countries, you know, in and around Eastern Europe. Mamash Ruach HaKodesh Nisukah Pikacho. Yet the Rebbe of Unsdorf had a divine revelation. Nowadays, look where we've come. There's no one left. Look, everyone is gone from the countries where I come from. And he knew about it. And this Rebbe wanted to inspire those people who are God-fearing, right? The most religious. Lakitz otam mitardei motam, and to wake them up. Lakima mit atzlutam in nekuda hazot, and to get them, sort of moving in this one point. Aval, masha avar avar. But he said, what happened? What's this geshen? You say in Yiddish, what's geshen is geshen. What happened has happened. Uke'et sheganu bavotena rabim nitgashmud nevotosh rabbein hakon. Now we see, we've got nowhere to go. They didn't have Israel. Look what a broch we live in a world where there's a Medinat Israel. And we need to say that. I think almost we should, I wish the rabbis would make that one of the brochas you say every day in the morning. Right? Shalos sani goy, shalos sani this, shalos sani that, whatever. Shalsal lanu medinat Yisrael. It would be wonderful if such a bracha would be said every single day. That we would not forget what a world we live in, that we do have somewhere to go. And our grandparents had nowhere to go, and we have some. I'm just going to stop crying, it's terrible, it's very emotional this. And he says, the labevet divrei rabbeinu, and he basically sort of talks about what the other rebbes had said, etc. It's just breathtaking. The whole book, it's available in English, and it is such a powerful book. Rabbi Yisachar Teichtal Zechatav Livroch, a very, very incredible man. And this, again, I heard about him through my studies. When I was studying the writings of Rav Kook, the teacher said, you must find out about Rav Teichtal. When he showed me the picture, I said, you've got to be kidding me. All right, you know, this is not the obvious-looking gentleman. And he said, don't judge a book by its cover. In this case, the book, you know, it's got a nice cover. The reality is, this was an incredible man. And I actually bought some of his other books. He wrote Responsa as well. Phenomenal. What do I want to say, sort of as a conclusion, because we're coming to the end of our time? We're living in a world where, you know, all these sound bites, BDS and anti-Israel sentiment, and we're worried now is the support for Israel in the Congress, what's it going to be like with all this new intake of pro-Palestinian Congress people, etc., etc. And all of that, you know, is something that rightly we should worry about. I'm more concerned about the average American Jew, who may not necessarily be more religiously motivated, but is now not feeling that connection, that obligation towards Israel, which I think we all grew up in. I certainly grew up in a world where it doesn't matter, you're religious, not religious, that Israel was a given, that you would support Israel, that ideally you would go, or at least, you know, you would always be there to be there for the fundraising. I lived through the Six-Day War, and I remember what it was like, you know, all of that sense of impending doom, followed by incredible jubilation, and everything that went around, everything that happened at that time, it was unbelievable, more than unbelievable. And all of this is something which, in the course of years, seems to sort of, you know, gets watered down. And again, I quote Reb Haskel Lukstein, who I always feel is a man of great wisdom. Should be gesund, you know, he's sort of well into his 80s now. He said 20 years ago, I was teaching at Ramaz, and he had an assembly. And it was at the time of the Intifada, just that 2000, 2001, again, when I wrote this whole thing down. And he said there literally is now a fight for Eretz Israel between the Jews and the Arabs. And he says, who is going to win this battle? The people who are more passionate about Israel. He said, and saying to students, but boy, that was so, so, so powerful. If we are passionate about it, and if we are not passionate, we've got to renew that passion. And if it means another trip or another course in studying the basic history of Zionism. I mean, today you've got a potted history, but do a proper history. Read those books. Read the new books that are coming out. Yossi Kleiner Levy, such a nice, good writer. Michael Oren, all the people have written these wonderful sort of books that if one hasn't read, one should read. You know, renew that sense of wanting to know. Again, studying the sources, studying the religious sources, goes without question. But be inspired by a Rav Teichtal, by a Rav Kook, today by Rabbanim, who are not ashamed, are not embarrassed about declaring their fantastic awareness of what a miracle Medinat Yisrael is. Right? There's not time to prevaricate. On the campuses, I'm at Columbia every day, and I think we're coming up to Apartheid Week in another 3 or 4 weeks, and it just blows my mind that they get away with this and claim that the one country in the world where, you know, there's a Muslim lady who's part of a Knesset delegation at the moment going around the world trying to tell the world this country is so far from apartheid. don't know what you're talking about. You know, it's the only country in the Middle East where she is allowed to be a member of Knesset, a member of government, and she's not only that, she's Muslim and everything else, and she's given freedom of everything. He says, if this is apartheid, then you don't understand what apartheid was. And she says this so openly, and I heard this speech last week. She gave it, I don't know where it was, I think somewhere in America. And the reality of it is, I think we're at a crossroads, certainly with the younger generation. What I'm very upset about, and I'll just sort of leave on this point, if we can do anything to reverse this, is the issue of birthright. Birthright has been a phenomenal success. Taking young people to Israel on a free trip, been running now for probably, 15, 16 years. And all of a sudden, even there, the I'm going to call it the enemy, because the only word I can use, is trying to get its hands on it, and to change it into something which it isn't. If you're going to Israel and you don't speak to affected Palestinians, then you're not having a true Israel experience. This is the line that is being used. And birthright is being attacked. And not only being attacked, I honestly believe in a few years it will disappear. I don't think it's going to continue. And I think that unless something drastically changes and people sort of, fight the fight, it's part of this pernicious sort of antagonism which is growing and growing, BDS and everything else. And it's a fight. It's a real battle that is going on. And again, you'll say to me, what can I do? I'm sitting in Cherry Hill and I'm doctor and I'm lawyer and I'm whatever I'm doing. Reality is that we can do things because we, by knowing ourselves and being confident ourselves in what we believe, what we stand for, surely that in itself is the beginning of influencing, people around us, people we talk to. It doesn't matter who it is. You never know, one conversation with person about this topic may come up and you said something and they've said, oh, I didn't look at it like that. I've always watched CNN and I read the New York Times, God forbid, and this is my whole view of the world. All of a sudden, people are maybe open up to see things in a different light. And I feel so strongly about it because it is a real, real battle on the campuses. It's a challenge. So am I optimistic for the future? We have to be. We're Jews. We can't live in the world without optimism because otherwise we would have given up the ghost a long time ago. The reality of it is that I really believe, and to me it's about recharging those batteries, ideally to get to Israel whenever we can, certainly to be connected, read about even if the next couple of months drives you nuts with all the different parties and all the different shenanigans and everything else, but this is what we've got. This is who we are. This is our country. This is it. But let's look at it so positively that we can have an election, that we can elect our own leaders, we have our own army, we have our own state, and Bezrat Hashem, we'll have Mashiach b'mehera b'yomeinu. Thank you, everybody. Oh. Thank you. Any questions, any comments, please?
I just wanted to, when you started and you talked about the political parties that were so distinctive. So I grew up in Israel in the 50s, and I lived in a building that was called Shikun Po'el HaMizrahi.
Po'el HaMizrahi, yeah.
Across the street was Mapai.
Yeah.
And the other one was the communist Mapam.
Yeah.
And never the twain shall meet.
Yeah.
We did not speak to one another.
Yeah. Yeah, I think today that maybe is less pronounced, I'd like to believe. What is the problem is you still have the school system where you have two doors, Mamlachti, secular, and Dati. At the age of three, the children go in two different places in the same building. Because that's what happened to my kids. And that still is something which upsets me. But
and also my grandfather was a strict of a chassid.
Yes.
Related to a gera chassid, I think. And he also saw he was an ardent Zionist.
Yes.
He lived in Mea Shearim, a monk in the Tur Karta, Zionist haters in the world. And they respected him because he was such a great tzaddik. But we were there, visited in the 60s or in the 70s, early 70s, and we're listening to the radio in his house. At his one-room house in Mea Shearim.
Yeah.
And as soon as the Chadashot came on, we had to stop talking. We had to listen
all the
very
time.
Carefully.
Yeah, yeah.
And if Hatikva was playing, he would stand up.
Yeah.
I mean, he was such a Zionist.
Yeah.
He left Europe in the
30s. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I want those voices to be revisited. Just, to read about them, to know about them. You have that first-hand experience. It's too important today, particularly if you want to tell our children and grandchildren. To get that message across, we've got to be inspired, otherwise they won't be inspired. If they don't hear it from us, from the teachers, etc. Yeah.
So you mentioned about the Mizrahi movement. In Israel, it is growing very strong, not necessarily as a political party, I'm not sure about that, but as a movement to train future leadership. And our son is very involved with this, and he will be, they now have created a smicha program, which he will be one of the first 10 students in. And one of the requirements is to go on shlichut, you know, to make sure that you leave Israel. In the early years when you become a rabbi and wherever you're, you know, you may end up, that you're trying to educate and inspire.
So
I think hopefully that's one of the kernels of hope, that there will be this there, very
and it's coming from the right place. And if Mizrahi is going in that direction, that's probably where it should have been a long time ago. You know, forget the politics, you're not going to get so far in that, but educational, phenomenal.
Just a comment, this past week I was at a shiva house of a patient who's Israeli, left maybe 30 years ago, has very little connection to the country, and lives in a very secular area, very few Jews, but commented that none of their friends had never been to Israel, and very little connection with Israel. And they were commenting on how the birthright movement was tremendous success, not just for the kids, because they watched all of these people whose kids went on it, and he said across the board, every one of them, subsequent to the kids going, the parents ended up going. And they had no connection to Israel, and so the kids got the excitement after having gone on the birthright trip, and then followed that the parents went.
I have even better story. One of the girls from Barnard College went for the first time in her life to birthright, is now married to an Israeli living in Tel Aviv. So that was a real success. You know, that was the whole package. And to her credit, she was just fell so in love with the country. That was it. And that's what it's about. It's really what it's about.
Excuse me.
Sure.
What I get from your conversation, your presentation, was that the religious observant or rabbis, I'm not talking about less observant, they're less adept at realizing the political reality of what you have to do to have a state, and they were against it.
At the beginning.
They didn't
understand
it as much as they understood what was in the Talmud.
Correct.
So they have to respect some of the things that are coming out of the secular Jewish world.
Correct.
And realize there's got to be a fusion of both ideas.
Correct.
And that's
true.
You know, I talked to people, they said in the 20s, they never even thought of coming to Israel or coming to the United States. They kept on saying it's a TRAFE world.
TRAFE,
and all that
correct,
sort of stuff.
Correct.
My father left Europe in 1920.
But not so common.
How do you change people's ideas of what they are? And to make a person understand that his training is not, what should we say, aware of the political realities of what it takes to build a state. You need both.
Sounds like you needed really respected religious leaders who had open minds, because if it came from, like, the guy that you quoted, and other people who were respected for their Torah knowledge, and they saw it, then, you know, once they gave the blessing, then other people said, okay, it's all right. But if you don't have the people that are schooled and learned, who happen to be blessed with the perspective, you know, otherwise the rest of the rank and file Jews who are not going to go.
What you're saying is 100% true.
Yeah.
But you have to have you have to have listeners to the people.
There's listeners and leaders. I'm just going to add one comment because I very deviously missed out one name of this in this presentation, which is Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik was the ultimate example of what you've spoken about. He was a member of the Aguda at one time and was very much part of that world, came from Eastern Europe, and saw that if you don't support Mizrahi and go through to modern approach to religious Zionism, etc., etc., he's failing his mission, and supported it in such a strong way and with such positive comments, etc., and with his actions. A phenomenal man. I mean, and that is the leadership which, thank God, inspires still a whole generation of what I would call sort of Talmidei of Soloveitchik, modern Orthodox rabbis, etc., in and around, not only America, but around the world. And that's the hope. And what I'm saying is we need to just revisit those writings, read about those people, because they are inspirational. Rav Teichta, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Kook, inspirational. Not just great men, but inspirational people. I just wish I would have met some of them. I didn't even meet the Rav, but I'm sorry about that.
Have you ever heard of Rabbi Finkel?
Findel, yes.
Okay, so I went to Hank, which is Hebrew Academy.
Yes,
Hank,
yeah.
I grew up,
Yeah, he lives in Israel. Lives in Israel.
He's been in Israel for 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
He was the dean, the founder of the school.
Right.
And, I mean, it's a huge school now, but yeah. It was even when I went. But every assembly and every, and this is in the 60s and 70s, every time we had an assembly or an event or whatever, you know, a talk, he quoted Rav Kook. I mean,
yes.
I grew up, like, here,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
I can't remember, but everything. And, like, it inspired a lot of people, including my sister, to say, you know, she wanted to live in Israel.
Live in Israel.
And she always yeah. remembers that. And she says,
yeah.
you know, this is how, what we heard. And it's true. We heard it, I would say, on a daily, if not weekly basis.
Yeah.
He would get up, and whatever he was talking about in school, there was always her reference.
Yeah. And that's the way to go. And you're lucky. And
well, what is so scary is that the talented, bright young people on campuses today that are fighting for BDS are Jews.
Are Jews.
And so my daughter at NYU is, you know, now it's not the Haredi people that are speaking against
yeah.
Zionism. We're getting it from young, bright, developing Jews who feel that it's, you know, connected to their Jewish values to oppose Israel.
To oppose Israel. And that's...
leading the Palestinian effort on these campuses.
I know. And it's scary.
You know,
it's scary.
The reality
Sorry.
Is that anti-Semitism in this country, you know, I was born in a DP camp
yeah.
right after the war.
Yeah.
And since we came here, since I was two, I have never feared for being a Jew or being openly a Jew until now.
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh and everything.
The anti-Semitism in this country, unfortunately,
yeah.
is coming from the left.
Yeah. Which is the biggest shock?
And the right.
The right's always been nuts, but the left is the big
right
shock.
The anti-Semitism on the right has no political standing.
Yeah, yeah. But the left is the shock.
The left, they do.
Correct.
That's the dangerous thing.
That is the dangerous thing. That is. I'll just take the
Jewish
final comment, please.
I think one of the problems.
I'm not talking about the young Jews. I'm talking about
Is a lot of the anti-Zionism on the campuses.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I have to address that, you know, the conservative and reform movements, a lot of the leaders and the people are, you know, against the Orthodox and view those that are aligned with Israel as the Orthodox.
Yeah, yeah.
My daughter works for the B'nai B'rith Youth Organization.
Right.
Major thing where the kids go on to the campuses. And the leaders there are now, we are pro-Jewish, but they've gotten so much feedback from rabbis of the other movements, whatever, they don't really stress being Zionistic, pro-Israel,
right.
pro
right.
the BDS.
Right.
So it's really, again, with the, you know, unless the religious and the non-religious can somehow come, I think that definitely has an impact
Correct.
On how the Zionism works.
Correct.
I didn't get what you said. I don't understand.
Well,
say it again.
Zionism and being pro-Israel nowadays in the non-Orthodox community is viewed, being a Zionistic as being Orthodox, because Israel is against, you know, women's rights for the wall and won't recognize conservative reform, and so the non-religious are now...
Uniform. You can't make a huge difference.
I said the non-religious.
That's the perception.
This is what's happening.
That's the perception.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying that what I hear with the BBYO, which is where the things are going.
Yeah, that's why I stayed clear of it. I stayed clear of it.
The leaders are
I'm gonna let the conversations continue, because that's part of the fun of this, that is generating conversation, which is really what I'm happy about. Sorry?
The Gemara part that you quoted.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
Is it possible that the reason this is in the Gemara at this time is because of what happened after Korban Bayit Rishon? And a lot of the rabbis did not want, there were different factions who, you know, rebelled against the Babylon, the king, the Nebuchadnezzar.
That is a great segue into the next presentation. That's what we're going to be talking about. The whole issue of Megillat Esther is about return to Eretz Israel. You never knew this, but you will find out, Bezrat Hashem, in 4 weeks,
yeah.
please God.
Oh,
all right, thank you everybody for coming out this snowy day. Really appreciate your participation, and have a great day. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.